Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage at Augmented World Expo 2026, today's episode is starting into some of the conversations I was having about artificial intelligence. And so this conversation is with Trond Nielsen, who is a XR software engineer who's been working in XR for many, many years, studied under Tom Furness. And so we talk about his evolution and journey into XR, but also these different dynamics of artificial intelligence and the intersection into XR. And so there's a certain way in which that AI has infiltrated the deeper culture of software engineering and software programming, where it's kind of so deeply ingrained and embedded into so many different software development practices that it's almost expected that you are going to have to use these different tools and technologies in a certain way, especially if you want to keep up with the demands of the short development cycles and also just be in alignment where the larger trends of software engineering are going. For me, I have lots of different concerns around what does this mean for the future of computing, especially when there's all these hyperscalers that are basically subsidizing all of these subscriptions. I saw that Ed Zitron was reporting that for one of the $200 subscription fee for Anthropic, it would actually take around $13,000 to $14,000 worth of compute that Anthropic was just eating, because there's this pressure for these hyperscalers to push out this technology with all this huge amounts of VC funding. That's just a huge incinerator of cash. And it's like getting all these people dependent upon all these different systems in a way that, for me, it just feels like a concerning amount of consolidation of wealth and power into the hands of a handful of people that are creating this vision of techno-feudalism, that are kind of extracting the value out of the free distribution of a lot of this code and information out on the internet to repackage it within AI and then basically sell it at a huge price, but in a way that's actually bringing a lot of utility for people. So there's a certain amount of pragmatism where Trond talks around like, well, that's just kind of the reality of where things are going at. There's not much choice to really fight back against that. So he just kind of has to submit to that. And I guess my position of resisting against some of these different inevitability arguments of AI is that there may be aspects of resisting or potentially, hopefully, finding these more open models that are not dependent upon these systems that are completely closed and creating this techno-feudalist future. And so I think Trond is on the same page of not really feeling great around what the hyperscalers are doing and wanting to support different aspects of the open source models. But in terms of performance, they're not quite there yet for him to do a full switchover and defining something that would be achieving the same level of results. But I think there's this like deeper aspect of what is the ethics around AI. And I think there's a bit of pragmatism and utilitarianism, which is essentially that I find value out of it and that the harms that I see are not as great as the benefits I am personally receiving out of that. And I think a lot of those harms are hidden and a lot of the costs of the ghost and machine that digs into a lot of that. But also, it's just not easy for people to make that ethical calculation when some of the different extreme harms may be speculative things that happen in the future that have not happened yet. So we don't know the full implications of that. But we can see a bit of the writing on the wall for what might happen, for what type of future we're living into. And so, yeah, it's a bit of where things are at right now versus where they may go here in the future, but have yet been realized. So it's more of a speculative fear rather than something that's actually been actualized. So anyways, a really quick conversation where I wanted to just get the perspective of a software engineer on the front lines of XR that I think actually captures a lot of the spirit of what's happening in the broader field of XR. And in my conversation with Caitlin Krause, as well as the Socratic Dialogue on the Future of XR and AI, I'll dig into more of these different conversations. But essentially, there's this contextual approach of seeing the different benefits and harms. And without these protections from like something like the AI Act in the EU is like preventing different aspects of automated decision making that is feeding into the same models that are being used for policing or to send people to jail, do facial recognition, these different types of things that are not great uses for AI in a way that the consequences of things going wrong, I mean, people have their human rights violated and unjustly get sent to jail. And so the EU has said, hey, let's not have that aspect of AI and have these use cases that are not allowed. But here in the United States, we don't have any of those guardrails. And so we have this democratically backsliding authoritarianism that is also the deeper political context here in the United States, and also these different types of tools and technologies that are going to continue to be used to consolidate that wealth and power in a way that I think is completely unethical. But most of my work that I'm doing here on the podcast is around oral history and knowledge production and not necessarily around coding. And so some of that calculation of the benefits I get versus the costs and risks are a little bit different than folks that are doing coding day to day. So anyway, we cover all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Trond happened on Thursday, June 18th, 2026, at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Okay, well, my name is Trond Nilsen. I teach XR at the University of Washington. I've been in the space for about 25 years, sort of in and out of academia and industry, mostly small consulting type things. Spent 5 years doing VR treatments for chronic pain, chronic stress, chronic anxiety. These days, I build some 3D tools for various applications in construction while working a day job doing medical devices.
Nice. And so maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into VR.
Yeah, sure. So I started out, originally I started at the HitLab in New Zealand. I was working at a company doing websites in 2002. We were about to do some pro bono work for a new lab that was starting up. And I just happened to be the engineer who got called in to help out with this project. And sitting across the table is Mark Billinghurst, who you may know is one of the authors of the AR Toolkit. He was starting up a new lab. I talked for half an hour with them about this website that they needed. And fairly shortly after, just decided to quit my job and go back to university. Did a master's degree there in New Zealand doing tabletop command and control applications. I built what I called the world's first tabletop real-time strategy game in 2004. Then a few years later, came out to the US to do a PhD with Tom Finesse at the University of Washington. I was building ontology-driven games for teaching human anatomy with intelligent tutoring systems. So that's a bunch of buzzwords, but basically building 3D games for teaching anatomy, using AI to model what the student knows, and then using medical ontologies, which are kind of like knowledge graphs for the representation of the knowledge that you use for that. So it was a real fun project. Got involved with hackathons and things in Seattle, ran about 10 or 11 of those there, ran some in some other countries, ran a lot of meetups, and met Kent through that. Yeah, sort of did a lot of that, then did medical applications in XR. Then the other big thing I do is I'm involved in both the XR Guild and the Virtual World Society, at which I am the treasurer of one and the treasurer emeritus of the other. So I do a lot of community type work through those nonprofits.
Yeah, and I'd love to dig into the questions around AI because it's hot on my mind. And I know that we've had a few conversations over the last couple of weeks about this and that. Yeah, just love to hear some of your first initial thoughts of where you stand on the intersection of AI and XR and how you start to think about both the promises and perils and how to navigate that as a developer.
Yeah, I'm really torn on AI because in some ways, like there are applications of AI that are really, really destructive to the communities from which that material was derived. So I think particularly of artists whose work is being taken in ways that are, you know, ethically dubious and used to generate other art, which really, really messes with those people's livelihood. I'm a software engineer, and so for me, I use AI on a daily basis, and the training material for that came mostly from things like Stack Overflow and GitHub, which are already open platforms, so the ethical case for should this stuff have been used is a little bit different. And also, for most practicing engineers, AI doesn't replace you, it augments you, it gives you a tool set to use. So I think there's a really important distinction you have to make between AI applications that replace human capability and AI applications that allow humans to reorient themselves or take away some of the grunt work that they do. I find, for example, that using AI for engineering, it allows me to explore a lot of ideas that I just simply would not be able to explore otherwise. And then also, though, it lets me to really focus a lot more on quality. So it used to be when you're coding, right, you've got a certain amount of time available to do a task. The thing works. I guess I better stop now because I'm running out of time. I got to move on to the next thing. Now, because I can get the AI to do the scut work, I can sort of sit back and think a bit more about the implications of the specific choices that are being made. But this is not a case of AI being used to replace an engineer or vibe coding an engineer. This is much more a tool for an engineer to do things. So it's like having a more efficient spanner in that sense. So I like that. But then the other side of this is the whole centralization of power thing, right? I'm very excited about the idea of AI models that can run on your device, or you can sort of hack something yourself and run it in your cloud and it's yours and it's and all that. I'm not so keen on the whole centralization of all the power goes to OpenAI or whatever. And of course, there's some environmental issues related to that. So, you know, on the fence in many ways, but I do use it a lot on a day-to-day life. There were some interesting things someone said to me yesterday. I think it was Avi Vazev said something about one lens on this is that XR is a tool that's really most effective at augmenting humans. And AI is a tool that, if misused, is very effective at replacing humans. And that's a really important distinction. So AI isn't inherently bad, but it is very, very easy to use for bad things, I would think.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to be on a panel discussion, the Socratic debate on the future of immersive media, and taking a little bit of the provocation of, I think it's unethical to use AI, especially with the large language models that are coming from OpenAI, Anthropic, Gemini, Grok, you know, all of these that are hyperscalers that have, you know, and you say it's open platform, it's technically not, in terms of they don't have, it's copyright, so they're still kind of seizing the data and using it without consent.
Most open source projects on GitHub come with a license, and I don't trust at all that OpenAI have respected those licenses. But predominantly, the licenses on those software projects are MIT licenses, which are free for use for any purpose.
So have they avoided using any GPL license code?
I 100% expect that they have not.
So that's one example of how they're violating the GPL license.
I mean, my attitude is it's not that I think that they are like art bad, code good, because I fully expect that some of the art they used was in fact public domain, and some of the code they used was definitely not public domain. And so I think it's one of these things, if we've got a rough cloud of clearly problematic stuff here and another rough cloud of things that may be a little bit less, averagely less problematic there. But I mean, I share the concerns about the hyperscalers and the centralization of power of all of this. But yeah, it is the world we're in.
Well, I think there's this kind of dilemma of this battle between like human rights and pragmatism, where ultimately the human rights of doing things are going to be in right relationship to everybody is being squandered by a utilitarian approach of things that you get pragmatic utility out of it. But yet there's the cost, which is that we're empowering these trillionaire hyperscalers to be able to basically potentially create this techno-feudalist future where you have to pay for all the compute that they're doing. They're subsidizing it with lots of VC cash, where they're just like, basically it's an incinerator for money. Yeah. They're getting you addicted to this thing that you're becoming dependent upon, but yet they're doing it in a way that something that's completely unsustainable, and they're going to be going public and being fast-tracked into the Dow Jones to be able to essentially do a vast wealth transfer and basically destroy one's 401k. So I feel like it's completely unethical to use them at all.
That's pushing it. I'm not convinced that it's that extreme a thing, but I do share that concern that we are in that sort of classic tension between the power of technology, let's do this cool thing, and then not think about the externalities that come along the way. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like part of the challenge is a lot of the things that we might worry about, like the impact on the markets, for example, it could have that impact, and that would be bad, and that would be unethical. Like, if I knew that they were going to do these things and they were definitely going to destroy people's 401ks and definitely going to do that, like, if I knew that there was a definite negative outcome, then it becomes a lot clearer to say this is unethical to do. But I feel we're in more of a world where these are all possible directions, right? We don't really know exactly where anything can go. We can predict some things. We can maybe not predict other things with quite such confidence. And so it's kind of a lot harder to make clear-cut ethical calls on definitely don't or definitely do. And the other side of this is you have to look at your own livelihood. This is more reality. I got kids. I got to pay for my kids, and my job requires that I use AI because that's what's necessary to stay up to date in that particular industry. So it's very hard to just say no purely on an ethical grounds for something that may or may not come to pass in the future when the alternative is not being able to feed my kids, right? And this is going to be the case for other people. But of course, then there's the other side of, you know, maybe this is going to do things that make it impossible for people to feed their kids later. So, you know, we're in a horrible gray area. I would like it if we didn't have to quite make these calls constantly, but it is what it is. So
what kind of explorations of open models have you been doing? And I'm just curious to hear if you've done explorations to see if you could replace things like OpenAI or Anthropic, Claude, Grok, or Gemini, whatever you may be using, if you find that it will hopefully be possible at some point to use completely open models, or if they're just not there yet, or if you continue checking in, or what's your process for navigating that?
So I haven't done much yet. I keep saying I want to, but of course it ends up falling on the giant pile of projects I want to work on that I haven't had time to work on. One of the things I'm heartened by is the asymmetry in AI between model construction and model usage, which is just that it requires a vast amount of energy to build models as opposed to the amount of energy that's required to run a model. It's sort of thousands to one or more ratio between how much juice goes into running the model versus using the model. And the implication of that is that it becomes much more likely that good models can run on individual hardware, so where you can host the entire thing locally or in a small cloud owned by you or whatever. So I'm fairly optimistic that the main competitive advantage that the hyperscalers have right now is they are able to marshal vast amounts of capital and resources to build more powerful models. But I'm reasonably convinced that the more powerful the model is actually not the best way to think about it. And this is partly because my experience with things like Claude and so forth is that if I use the best model, the most powerful model, and I give it lots of thinking time, I don't get the best results. I get better results when I use a model that is a bit more stupid, has less time to think, and does exactly what I tell it to. And so I feel like there is a very practical and workable ecosystem of AI models that are not the most complicated ones, not the hardest to run, likely to be plausible to run either on local PC or a cloud-based PC or even on like dedicated AI chips. And there's some companies here, there's a company behind you, Femto AI, they've gone unfortunately, but they're making dedicated silicon for running small models on. And so, you know, we could easily end up in a world, give it 3-4 years, where most consumers aren't using AI in the cloud, they're using AI in a device that they own. Now, I probably have issues with those devices because I imagine the first 10 generations of that are going to be all closed platform, normal corporate crap. But I also anticipate that models will either be made public or be escape into the public domain that are good enough for a lot of purposes that you, if you want to stay off the grid, you can. So, you know, sort of more open sourcey type approaches to AI. So I'm optimistic that that will happen. And to be honest, a lot of the conversations I've had here this week have been all, how do we make this more of an open platform? So that's optimistic. I'm really, really excited to see that that's the thing other people are thinking about.
Yeah, I was talking to Lee Ambrosia, who is making this kind of Linux box that can be used to host your own AI and your own network that's driven by Linux. And so there are some other examples of folks that are not on the floor here, but folks that have been in the industry that I came across and talked to. So I feel like that there's this open source and Linux-based systems is something that I get really excited about, because that seems to be, especially GPL code, I know that MIT is very popular, but MIT basically gets co-opted by all the big tech companies and basically empowers them. So.
Yeah, we've sort of really seen with this massive suck that's gone down, the limitations of the MIT license is that you just can't control it. It's going to get used for anything. That doesn't mean that the GPL has necessarily actually protected anybody. But as I say, I assume these companies have sucked up plenty of GPL code into their models. That sounds problematic, but yeah, I would far rather see GPL code be the standard for any kind of system-level application. I think there's a solid argument for why GPL doesn't get used in application code and library code very much, because it really makes it very difficult to start businesses based on it. But when you're talking about platform code, it seems like just a no-brainer, because it is not generally the case that you want other people to be able to take that and mess with it in the same kind of way. And there's also a sort of a cleaner division between the operating system level code or the lower level code and the higher level. So I, for example, I use Linux every day, all the time. It's GPL, I write code on all the time, but because I'm not linking to it in that kind of way, I don't have to use GPL licenses just because I'm using it. So my surface between me or my usage and the GPL code is a usage layer versus a linking or a code layer. And so that's a nice clean layer that you can have a very thriving GPL ecosystem underneath it without me having to sort of necessarily slot into that, which, as I say, sort of makes it very difficult for me to do various types of business things. Like if I'm offering hardware and I have an SDK, I can't release that GPL. That's just going to screw up everyone who wants to use it, and I'm just going to have no customers. So I think there are different niches. I don't know that MIT license is actually the best in that choice. The MIT license is, I think, the one people use because it's the simplest and because it's kind of fire and forget. You just don't have to worry about it once it's done. You're kind of just putting up your hand and saying, whatever, just use it for whatever, just don't blame me, right? It's kind of the don't blame me license in many ways.
Nice. And any other thoughts or things that you're getting excited about in terms of hope and optimism to fight the trillionaire hyperscalers?
This is maybe a little bit self-oriented. I've been hosting unconferences up in Seattle for the last couple of years. We just did one here at AWE. We got a couple hundred people signed up for that. And I'm really loving the reaction we're getting to that format. Unconferences were really popular as a method. Say 10, 15 years ago, there was FooCamp, all the stuff that O'Reilly was doing with us. There was just a much more thriving community of these events. And I love these events because they invert the power dynamic of a conference. Conferences have this power dynamic where, you know, get in if you know the organizers, or if you have a represent a company with money, or you've got like a book that's out or whatever, which is great. You know, that's great that people get to promote themselves. It's great the company gets to promote themselves. That is useful. But it doesn't support conversations between individuals who may have different or alternative or surprising sort of perspectives. And so I really like that I'm sort of seeing, like, we've been running these, and I'm seeing sort of other people talk about this. So I sort of like this idea that conversation is coming back. And the other thing I'm liking is this is sort of a side effect. I'm hopeful about this as a side effect of AI, which is that even though I don't like the way it messes with people's jobs, it does mean that people with ideas can spin out companies much faster. And that lowers the barrier to people with an idea who want to do a startup, and it significantly lowers it. You can do so much now bootstrapping in your spare time that I am hopeful that this will result in a lot more people trying ideas, and that inherently diminishes the power of incumbents because it's easy for competitors to say, well, you know, I like the direction, but you know, your product sucks, or you've incentivized it, I hate it, I don't want to do it. I'm going to make my own and I'm going to get out on the market. That becomes so much easier now. So I'm somewhat hopeful that we will see more people trying that kind of stuff. And then similarly, I'm hopeful that we'll see more people putting out tools. There's been this design trend over the last decade or two. We call it incentivization to some extent, but it's also just in design. We reduce functionality to like a limited set of what we want, what we think 80% of people want, and we hide the complexity. And we used to think that design was about sophistication was the goal. You want to have a lot of power. It'd be all about more things you could do. Now it's about making it as simple as possible. And I feel like the barrier's gone between, or the movement's gone between making things simple to making things simplistic, because that's all we want people to do. We want to maintain engagement. We don't want to give you power. We just want you to keep coming back and giving us more money. So I'm hopeful that we will see more people building tools that are closer to what they actually need versus just using the thing that Google put out because it's easy. I'm doing a side project myself at the moment, for example, to build an alternative interface for YouTube, which is specifically designed to not use YouTube's recommendations, but instead use a recommendation algorithm that I have put together specifically for my five-year-old. So he can watch his Minecraft videos, but instead of getting recommended stuff that I don't want him seeing, it recommends at the end of the video things that I want him seeing. And it also lets me do things like manage his time. And that's the thing that I would never have taken on without AI, but with AI to help me code it, it's been 10, 15 hours to build this thing. That's the only way he watches videos anymore. My in-laws want copies. So, you know, that kind of thing I'm excited to see happen more of.
Nice. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of XR and AI and all these future spatial computing might be, and what it might be able to enable?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's being a bit joked here at AWS this year that we're in one of the downswings again. The event is much more spread out than usual, which I think is making things feel a bit less close and intense. It's not so packed, right? You have less of a critical mass of people close to each other that makes the event feel busy. I think it's partly because they're using a different space to the bigger space. And they've also told me they've spread things out intentionally, so it feels less busy than usual. But it does feel a bit like we're in a downswing. And that doesn't surprise me, given various things you see in the news and the uncertainty that comes out of the madness of current politics and world affairs. So that's depressing. But I like to see this as kind of like downswings are opportunities for loose weight to fall off, things that aren't really working to sort of stop, and for people to sort of recondition and think about what's next. I think when we talk about XR and AI, there's a lot of talk about, well, of course, they go hand in fist. And yeah, in some ways they do, because XR leans heavily on tracking, and tracking is basically best done through a machine learning approach. But I'm not convinced that the big AI companies that we're talking about necessarily have much to do with XR at this point in time. So I do have optimism for the field. I do think we are seeing devices. Obviously, smart glasses, we're expecting a bit of a wave on that. We'll see how they go. I saw a smart glass provider here that I'm really excited about because it's a very open platform, Raven. They have an open sort of Linux-based platform. They have hot swappable batteries. They have hardware ports so you can make custom hardware to go with it. So that's the sort of thing I want to see, is hardware platforms that let hackers do cool stuff. So, you know, I'm actually fairly optimistic despite the world situation. The question is just, is the world situation going to get better in such a way that finance will end up in the right places to support these things? And will people be able to afford it themselves? Because, like, cost of living, it's getting real tough these days. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, Tron, thanks for all your deep insights for what's happening on the front lines of an XR engineer and computer programmer on the XR industry. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.